Thank you, Bill. All right. Favorite part of the evening, our speaker tonight has an awesome story. You know, when COVID first started, I would talk to my friends and be like, can you imagine trying to get sober as COVID is starting and you can't go to any, you know, it's really tough to get to a live meeting and most meetings are on Zoom. Wouldn't that be tough? Wouldn't that be tough? Well, you're about to meet a guy who did it. 2 years he's got. He did it through all the COVID. You know, his home group is Attitude Modification Friday mornings. And I believe you're from Visalia, right?
Yes.
All right. So please give it up for Jeff B. Hello, everybody. I'm Jeff B. And I'm an alcoholic. That's true. I am a baby Zoomer, I guess you could call me. I learned the program through Zoom, basically. 2 years ago, yesterday is my second birthday. And I'm the kind of guy who never really gets things right. I'm still working at it. The program's helping me start to get things right. But my actual birth date is February 29th. Which, it didn't happen yesterday. Yesterday was March 1st. The 29th only comes around once every 4 years. It's a leap year day. And how I managed to choose that day, I don't know. God had something to do with it. I've got one of these apps on my phone that tells me how many days to my next milestone, and the app can't figure it out, so to my surprise. It says I still have 720-some-odd days to my next milestone. So, I mean, it totally has the thing all messed up also. So, yeah, I mean, it happened on the 28th of February 2020 was my last drink. And the 29th was my first day of sobriety. I had a crisis that night on the 28th of February, and my wife asked me to do something, and I texted one of my very, very best old friends who I knew was in this program. I said, I think I need help. I think I'm an alcoholic. He emailed me the big book the next morning, and I started reading, and I met with him a couple of times. And I met with him once, and then I went to about three or four live meetings before COVID shut everything down on March 13th, I think, 2020. 2 years ago. And so that whole time, you know, I was recovering, you know, from alcoholism, trying to recover. But at the same time, my wife was recovering from a major perforated bowel surgery, and I almost lost her. And so when it comes to that story and that crisis, because she's in complete physical recovery also, so we're both recovering. And so it's been really quite a process. How it was and how I started, I really grew up with no alcohol in the house. My family does not have an alcoholic background. I'm proof that alcohol is going to beat you down whether you lived with it before or not, whether somebody in your family lived with you before or not. My first drink that I ever remember taking was after my sophomore year in high school. In the summer, at that time, I grew up in North Dakota, and I moved here when I was 15 years old and came to California. My cousin's fiance wanted me to drive his spare car to another town with him, and we spent the night there, and he gave me some rum and cokes. I don't remember much about it. I don't remember getting drunk or anything. And as a straight arrow, moved to California, and I finally decided, you know, I'm going to go out and party once. That was a big deal for me. I thought, you know, and the only reason why I did it is because I thought I might be missing out on something because everybody else was out there doing it. I got drunk on Ripple and took a couple of shots of weed, and I was home in bed by 10:30 that night. That was it. You know, don't remember a hangover. Don't remember drinking alcoholically. I've heard the stories. I drank a couple times in college socially. At one point when I transferred to Fresno State, I couldn't find a place to stay, so I lived at Sigma Chi fraternity for a while, moved out because they drank too much beer, and I really didn't like the taste of beer at that time. So moved out and got out of there, and then finally I remember one major hangover after my first year of teaching. And Didn't really start drinking till my 40s and started drinking regularly. And what happened is I was very successful with my teaching career from one program to the next. I taught middle school, two different high schools, and finally at a college. I got to the college, and I really ran into some obstacles, and I thought it was a pretty hot shot at what I did. And I felt I was overworked. I started to hold resentments, and I turned to alcohol to relax or stress, you know, to kill the stress or kill the pain of failure. I thought I might have been failing. You know, I thought that, you know, geez, what are people thinking of me? I'm supposed to be this really hot shot instructor that's built these programs at all these other schools. And now I'm not doing as well as I thought I should be doing. I thought it should be going a lot quicker. And so I started drinking after work, and that started it. And I started drinking regularly, a pint a day or more, for the next 15 to 20 years. I don't remember exactly how much, maybe more. On days when I could afford to drink more, I drank more. I let my job kind of dictate to me how much I would drink. Have a couple of drinks in the afternoon. If I had to go back to work at night, that night, I'd walk in with a buzz and finish off sober and hit more on the way home and go to sleep and start the day all over again. And I did that for 15 to 20 years. I couldn't stop it. I know that. It's kind of weird in ways. I'd go on vacations in the summers with my wife for 2 weeks and not drink. But then when I got home, I had to start backfilling. I had to catch up. So I'd hit a little bit harder, especially in the summer. And I did that for 15 to 20 years. I just kept on. And, you know, they talk about, you know, alcohol being an allergy and being allergic to alcohol. And I would say that that is true because I told you that I moved from North Dakota, you know, after my sophomore year in high school, and I did not develop allergies to the blossoms and the peach blossoms. I'm fighting it right now in the San Joaquin Valley here for 15 to 20 years. Well, it took me about 15 to 20 years of drinking alcohol before I developed that allergy, and it finally broke through the whatever physical or genetic barriers I had built that I had naturally in my system. It broke through. It broke through it. And so consistently through that whole program, that whole period of drinking, realizing what it was doing. And there were a couple of times my wife stopped and said, "Hey, you're drinking too much, back off." And I'd back off for a while. And then I'd start up again, and I kept on drinking in the closet. You know, I never really did drink a lot of beer or whiskeys or anything else like that. I went straight to vodka and diet soda, straight right away. You can't taste it. You can't smell it. That was my drink in tumbler cups. I was always walking around drinking the soda. You know, I was eating soda in my car all the time. And after work, I'd hit it and come home. My first sponsor says I'm a stupid golfer because I never drank on the golf course, which I didn't. I waited till I got in the car and then started driving before I started drinking home. I refused to drive a golf ball drunk, but I was more than drunk that all the time. You know, it's just irrational, completely non-logical thinking. Skipping ahead till after I retired, I did have some health problems. About 4 or 5 years ago, I developed atrial fibrillation, heart issues. Well, I'm in the hospital for 4 days, and they're saying, well, it must have been stress that brought it on. It must have been stress. I'm still hiding my alcoholism. And so, no, yeah, you're right. It must be stress. It must be stress. And they said, well, so they put me on these heart medications, to regulate the heart and keep it from racing and all this stuff. You can't drink. You think the doctors knew. I said, you can't drink. Well, about 2 to 3 months later, I'm going to go. Okay, a little bit more, all of a sudden, you know, my heart's feeling great, better than it was before, you know. So now I think, well, I've got the magic bullet. These medications I'm on are going to keep me. I can drink more, you know. So it was just that whole twisted logic. You know, I've got this magic pill now that's going to protect my heart so I can drink a lot more. Well, so anyway, going on, you know, I always told myself, you know, towards the end of my teaching career, I told myself that, you know, you're not going to get rid of this before you retire. You might as well ride it out to retirement and then quit after you retire. God, was that stupid thinking, you know, really stupid thinking. And right after I retired, all kinds of stuff hit the fan. My oldest daughter broke her wrist in four places in a skiing accident. That was my first day of retirement. We ended up taking the kids up to Sacramento. I couldn't have taught anyway. I retired mid-semester. Later on that year, my oldest daughter in Sacramento, her family was under the protective care of under protective surveillance by the California Highway Patrol. The whole family had been threatened by somebody, death threats from a guy who had lost his property or something. He works for the state. So the whole CHP, that went on for about a year before they caught the guy. Then my wife had seizures. She discovered she had epilepsy at the age of 61 years old. And then later on, her father develops Alzheimer's, just all kinds of crap stuff. And so I'm just still going on, and I'm drinking a little bit more and drinking all the way through this. Her dad eventually, about after she developed the seizures, about a year after that, she had her first bowel obstruction She lost 12 inches out of her colon. In all, I figure I have probably spent 44 nights in hospitals with her since I retired. And so she had that first bowel obstruction and, you know, other family crises going on. Then her father develops and put him in care. And right before he passed away, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. Then found out that so she had the breast cancer, and that was a year to a year and a half of surgeries and reconstruction. She had a couple more bowel obstructions between then, a couple more seizures. Found out then now she has Parkinson's disease to top it off. And then finally, what really came to a head for me was 2 years ago, last November, about 2 years ago and 3 months, 4 months, November 25th to be exact, in 2019, before I got sober, she had another major bowel obstruction. And she was on her way to Fresno and walked into a doctor's office up there. I was at home drinking. And she got sick, and they sent her to St. Agnes, the ER. And I drove up there. I don't know how I got there. I drove up there, and they filled her with drugs, and they said, well, you're feeling okay. So you got to go home. And she said, well, I need to have intravenously this drug called Keppra to prevent her seizures from her epilepsy. She said, no, we can't do that. You're okay, and we need the beds. So they basically kicked us to the curb, and I drove her home that night. But that night she got sick again, got her home, took her to Quia Delta, and they said, no, we can't find anything. She has a history of obstructions. Procedure, you're supposed to operate now, regardless. But they sent us home again. And so finally, Friday, they admitted her, and they still couldn't do it. So they're going to do what they call a small bowel pass-through, where they fill a radiation into their stomach and try to, and they x-ray it to see if it's going. Well, it never did move. And they, I don't know what happened. By Saturday night, she doesn't remember. She's blacked out with 4 or 5 days of this. Doesn't remember it. By most of Sunday night, I just held her at the side of the bed because she was writhing in pain, you know, doing all this. And I do remember praying many times in those hospital rooms, Lord, if you get her through this, I'll quit drinking. I don't know if I meant it. I don't know if I meant it. Lord, let me trade places with you. I'm just a miserable drunk anyway with her. Let me trade places with her. You know, why her, not me? You know, and that's honest. I just didn't know what to do. I'm sitting there holding there, and the room is completely dark, and the room opens up, the door opens up, and the head of surgery looks in and says, "What in the hell is going on in this room? Get her ready for surgery now." And so what had happened is they still had that fluid in her, and it hadn't been draining. They had stopped the NG pump to keep the stomach from pumping, because when you have a bowel obstruction, they got to take that stuff out of the stomach somehow. So they started scrambling, and they emptied 3.5-liter bottles from her stomach in half an hour before they got her to surgery. It took, the surgery was 8 hours long. It took them 3 hours to get through the scar tissue from the previous surgery. Her heart stopped in the middle of surgery. She had to go on support. And then finally finished at 8 o'clock. Now, if I hadn't been half drunk through the whole damn time, maybe I should have been more proactive in forcing the doctors to do something. I don't know. I might have cost her. I might have lost her. You know, I don't know. And, yeah, I do have, my daughter was there a lot, and so was her sister was there. And so they got her through the surgery. She was a week in ICU. She had peritonitis, sepsis, pneumonia, and gangrene. They took out two dead sections of the bowel that were about 8 inches long each. One had perforated, another 80 centimeters that had gangrene. And so as a result of that surgery, they found out now that she has what's called mesenteric ischemia, which means there are three major arteries that lead to the intestines. Two of them are permanently blocked. And they tried to put stents in them about a year and a half ago, and they couldn't get them through. So she's just got that one artery, and if it fails, it's a major bypass. It's trickier than getting to the heart. They have to go through the intestines, pull them out, get everything out. So at least we know what's happening, and she has what's called collateralization, where the artery is getting larger, the one artery, and other arteries are coming in. So we get her home, and they couldn't stitch her up because of the peritonitis and the sepsis. So they have what's called an open wound, and she got home on December the 5th, And they put this wound vac machine on her. It's a plastic sealer, and it sucks the crap out of her. And we have a two-story house. So she lived in the recliner downstairs. I slept on the couch downstairs that way for 2.5 months. I'm cleaning, doing dishes. But I had to change the bandages twice a day. It's called a wet dry bandage. And she looks like she's got the Grand Canyon down her stomach. Okay, and I'm drunk. Well, I'm in the morning for the first bandage changing. I'm so bad, my hands are shaking. I'm praying. You know, I'm telling her, I'm just nervous. I don't want to do this wrong. I don't want to do this wrong. That's why my hands are shaking. I stay sober until I got those bandages changed. And then as soon as the bandage came, she was incapacitated. She wasn't up getting around. So I stopped buying the little pints of vodka. I started buying the big ones and hiding it out in the garage. And as soon as I was done with those bandages, I'd go have a couple of drinks, and then I'd start cleaning the house, doing laundry, getting groceries, so we'll have somebody come and watch, doing all of that. It's lucky I didn't kill her. You know, it's just a damn miracle. And so that went on for another 2.5 months, and, you know, until she's finally up and around. And moving around, and we went to my grandson's little basketball game on Friday, the 28th. Yes, it was. And she noticed that she'd gotten there earlier, and I was leaving as I walked in, and I don't know how I got home, and I went home and fell asleep in the recliner, and she walked in and put the bottle, and she found the bottle in the garage, put it in front of me, says, "We're doing something about this right now." You know, and bless her. I mean, she has been my soulmate since I met her when I was 17 years old. We got married at the age of 20. We finished raising each other. She finished putting me through school. I think I did a better job of raising her than she did raising me, because I wouldn't be such a screw up if she'd done her job right. You know? Because she's an angel. I wouldn't be such a screw up, you know. But, you know, so, I mean, we've been through, we're going to have our 49th anniversary in June. And so, I mean, I know, I don't. Yeah, so. But I'm an example of what alcohol can do, purely due to a person at any age, at any time. You know, and I had always had been religious, gone to church all my life, raised in the Lutheran church, and I always think I had religion. I even read Bible studies, even, you know, up until, you know, I started going to AA. But I think I had religion, but I don't think I had faith. And I don't think I had a relationship with my higher power. I really don't. Because since that time, my eyes have been opened up to what is going on around us. I mean, just to see right here in this room what's going on and the miracles that are happening here right now. And to see, you know, just the miracle of being able to help somebody. You know, thinking in my selfish state while I was drinking and everything else, oh, it's an imposition for me to go to help. Oh, my daughter needs me to help. She's a single mom, you know, to help do something at the house, to fix something at the house or something like that. And it's such a blessing to be able to do that now. One of the prayers that I say is, you know, about self-will is, give me the ability to accept the blessings through the help of others and to ask for the help of others and not feel fearful or intimidated about what other people are going to think of me. I used to think if somebody wanted to help me, they must think I'm stupid and incompetent. I must be stupid and incompetent. You know, so one of the things I tell myself in that part of my prayer is that I should feel flattered that they've noticed me, and it's a magical transaction, you know, somebody helping and being helped. It's a magical transaction when that happens. And so those miracles to me are that is just an amazing thing. And you know, that once I started reading that book that morning, I said, this makes total sense. I know I can do it, and I realize now that God answered my prayer when I was praying probably multiple times in those hospital rooms with my wife. I will quit drinking. It didn't happen right then. It happened 3 months later, or 4 months later, or several years later, but he did answer that prayer, you know, and I had to realize that my life was unmanageable. You know, that I could not control my drinking. and no power greater than nothing less than a power greater than myself could stop it. And that is absolutely true. I think I'm blessed in the fact that I don't still crave the taste of alcohol because I never really liked it that much in the first place. I use it to medicate myself, you know. If it had been drugs in my cabinet, I would have used that or something else, you know, whatever easy it was. I used it to insulate myself from the feelings I was having. And the amazing thing about that is since I've become sober, I'm rediscovering those feelings. You know, I've been a performer. I'm a musician, taught music for years and years. Been on stage, talked to audiences forever, and felt comfortable doing it. But getting up here tonight, I was as nervous to start this as I was the very first AA meeting I went to. So what I'm feeling is, so you got me in the raw tonight. You know, I don't have, 3 years ago, I would have had something to drink before I started this. You know, I would have had something to drink. Okay, just to take the edge off, I'm going to relax and loosen up a little bit. You know, I'm going to have something to drink to get this thing started with. But it's just totally raw. And when I feel anger, I'm going, oh, yeah, I remember how that anger feels. Now what am I going to do about it? How am I going to ease that anger? And then when I'm happy, I'm just happier than I've been in years also. I mean, all the whole spectrum of emotions, it feels so great. It feels really, really good to feel that again, you know. And being a musician, I always have these stupid analogies. You know, it's funny. I listen to all sorts of music. I love classical music. I perform. I love jazz, rock and roll. On the way over here, I've got my iPod on shuffle. And all of a sudden, Sly and the Family Stone comes up and it says, "I want to thank you for letting me be myself." Okay, again. Right? Isn't that Say It? I mean, you're sober. I'm able to be myself again instead of having something manufactured, you know, or something medicating me, you know. And so that whole thing is really pretty amazing. Those whole 20 years, I have regrets, 15 to 20 years about drinking. I wonder how much more effective I would have been in my career if I hadn't been doing that, how much more efficient, how much more could I have accomplished. Could I have acted sooner to get my wife's surgeries taken care of? How much of my drinking affected her health in the first place? Knowing that I was still drinking all those years, how much did that affect her? There's lots of remorses and regrets and stuff, but God has a purpose in everything. And I'm here right now. I was here right now in that place at that time. She saved my life that night when she put down the ultimatum. I mean, she saved my life. She saved our lives together. And so I have those regrets, but at the same time, God's plan is God's plan. We don't have an inkling as to why or what. But since she's recovering, during her recovery, AA has given her, better have a drink of water. Basically, she's been in therapy for about a year or so. She has, you know, technically PTSD because she doesn't know what's going to happen next. That artery could shut down the next day. Everything else. I have PTSD from all those surgeries, but I was medicating myself or drinking myself through it. but so we are really recovering together, both emotionally and physically, because I think I'm still going through some physical changes. I've had 20 years of alcohol through my system. Things are healing. My liver functions are great, I guess. My heart condition, I'm off all the heart meds. Completely off all the heart meds. I just saw my cardiologist today, and he says to me, "What are you here for?" And I said, "Well, you told me to come and see." And he checks it out and says, "No, go home, see you later, see you in 6 months." You know, and so everything's cool. And my wife is a gym rat. She, with all the major surgeries she's had, she and her Parkinson's leg, you know, she's wobbly and shaky. But she goes, that's the best thing for Parkinson's is exercise. And she still drives around town. She doesn't drive highways. So you're safe on the highway. Just, you know, if you see a little red beetle with a tan convertible top, get out of the way. Just pull her aside and let her by. So she's a gym rat. She's really healthy, physically strong. She doesn't have the coordination in her hands. She's a lefty also, so the tremors in her left hand. She has trouble with bottle caps. It's writing her. She used to have beautiful artistic handwriting, cursive. And now it's scrunchy and squiggly and hard to read. And some days are better than others. You know, and some days, you know, she'll sit and cry, and it's a progressive disease. It's not going to be cured. There is no cure for it. They're not even sure if it's a single disease or multiple diseases in neurology. End of it. So she doesn't know what's going to happen next. We don't know if, you know, she's going to be here 2 days from now, you know, and so And with Parkinson's, she wears down in the evening, and so it's hard for me to get out. And so I am a Zoomer. I like Zoom. It makes it easy for me to get to a meeting and stay at home and stay close to her. And we're both making progress together. And my minister, I've been a member of Christ Lutheran Church over here since my family moved this year in 1969. And my minister gave us a really unique perspective. He says, you two get to do something together. You get to recover together. You from your alcoholism and her from her surgeries and her PTSD and everything else that's going along. And it's been rocky. It has been really rocky. The tools that AA has given me, my character defects, my shortcomings, going through my fourth step, realizing what I'm dealing with as I'm dealing with her, and trying to keep my shortcomings and my character defects from getting in the way of helping her, has been a daily occurrence. And from the point to just helping around the house or massaging her leg muscles or her hand muscles from tremoring all day. They waste energy. Those muscles are firing nonstop all day long, and they're getting tired from fighting it. And the emotions of Parkinson, her emotions are on a much wider swing. We call it, there's a lot of drama with Parkinson's. There are people who are drama people, drama queens, or whatever you want to call them. But with Parkinson's, it's extreme. It's extreme. The emotions, the anger, the joy, the happiness, the overreactions, that is Parkinson's. And I have been tested. My shortcomings, my character defects, I list them every morning, and I pray to God for the appropriate response, the opposite. Okay? I pray that God remove my self-pity and replace it with gratitude. Okay? Replace my stubbornness with an openness and willingness to hear your word and follow your ways. And my ego. I saw parts and bits and pieces. I know there's a book about the life of Walter Mitty, the guy who imagines himself to be this and do this and this. That's my brain. I'm the most fantastic musician. I'm the best athlete. Nobody's smarter than me. Everybody needs to praise me. Aren't I great? That Walter Mitty thing just goes off. And that's a part of my prayer, too. I says, even while I'm praying, I'll get off track on fantasies. And I got to go, come back, get back on task, And I know some people who are so phenomenally faithful, great Christians, and I know them really well, and they say the same thing. Their brains wander off during prayers. And as far as meditation, I think my sponsor said it best. My one sponsor says, he says, if you can focus for a couple minutes, that's pretty good. And whereas the meditation artists that can go 20 minutes or so, I'm not there. I think just being able to pull myself back on and get another couple of minutes and then wander off, pull myself back on, get another couple of minutes. As long as it's sincere and earnest and even what they say at the beginning, though, in AA says, if you don't have a faith in a higher power, fake it or try it. Just try praying even if you don't believe it, because eventually something's going to happen. And I think that's what happened to me, too. Is I started praying when I first got sober. I prayed like I've always prayed. But then something changed as I'm praying. Week after week, day after day, something started changing. And now I feel like I'm being comforted. I feel like there's somebody with me. There's something there with me. That higher power is there with me. So that whole thing, the AA has given me the tools at the right time to help me care for my wife. And what one of my prayers is help me to embrace the role of caregiver that you have given me. Help me to embrace it instead of regretting it, fighting it, begrudging it. This is what our retirement was supposed to be. This is not what our retirement was supposed to be. We were supposed to be off and traveling and doing all kinds of things. And we probably took our last long trip last summer. It was really hard on her. You know, we're going to stay close to home. But that's not what our retirement, what we planned to be, but tough. You know what? God's given me a job to do. I want to embrace it. I want to do it the best I can. And I'm going to do it the best I can. And do it sober. You know, I'm blessed. I mean, she is an amazing person. I hope I can do the job for her. We do have our battles still. We still have, every marriage will always have some battles, and we have some tears and, you know, a little bit of stuff. But right now, she's off singing in a church choir on her own. She sang in a rock band for 25 years locally. She gave it up when the breast cancer started, and she's got a marvelous voice. She hasn't sung in 5 years and then about a month ago, I said, let's go sing in our church choir. And I'm a musician. I've performed in symphonies, jazz bands, everything all my life, rock and roll bands, the whole thing. I don't need another performing group. I've done that all my life. But I said, let's get out and be social. Let's get you out of the house instead of trying to hide in a closet and hide your Parkinson's. Let's get out. Let's do it. And I enjoy it. I enjoy it. And she's out there singing tonight. She's worried about holding her music. You know, like this, and dropping it on stage in front of the congregation, stuff like that. So we got her a hook so she can tuck it into her stomach and just turn it with her other hand. And she's got her voice back. She has a marvelous voice. Really, really good. And so we're making progress. And, you know, isn't that what the book says? Our goal is not perfected, it's progress. And so, you know, I think that is all we can ask, is to just try to do something a little bit better. And as a music teacher, all the years I taught, I used to tell my bands that, but I didn't live that way in my life. I said, you know what, let's ask ourselves today, at the end of this rehearsal, were we better today than we were yesterday? I used to ask that. And I used to teach that, but I didn't live it with my own personal life. I did not live that with my own personal life. You know? And I still kick myself for mistakes, you know? And another thing I used to tell them too, you know, a lot of band musicians would be so afraid of making a mistake that they wouldn't play out, they wouldn't play enough or confidently enough. And I says, you know, this isn't parachuting, skydiving, or brain surgery. If you make a mistake, nobody's going to die. You know, I came close. There are mistakes that alcoholism will cause, that can cause death. Thank God it didn't happen. I walked up right to that edge. I walked up right to that edge. And I was at the point where I didn't care how much I drank at the end of the day. I started having blackouts probably 2 to 3 years before I stopped drinking. And I started noticing that, you know, I can't remember what my wife and I were talking about last night. I can't remember where I'm supposed to be this morning. I'm retired now, so I don't have a schedule. And she says, and I'd go fishing and say, so when we do this, oh yeah, and then she says, we're going to go over here, and then she'd fill in the blanks for me. You know, I used to have to throw out a line to try to figure out what are we doing, what's going on, because I had no idea. Occasionally, she'd catch me at it. She says, what's happening to your memory? What's happening? Oh, you know, I'm just getting old, you know. It's just that kind of stuff. What's happening to your memory? And I try to find my way through those blackouts. And, you know, so, and I have had, you know, but they talk about the taking the next drink. I have had that experience. I didn't quit just this time. I did quit a year before that, 2019, the January 1st, 2019. I quit on my own. I didn't use AA. I figured that I can quit drinking. Nobody's going to ever know that I was an alcoholic. I quit on my own. Nobody will ever know that I've been drinking all these years. Nobody's ever going to know that I was an alcoholic. I quit January 1st, 2019. No, it was 2018. And went all the way to June without drinking. And then my daughter started having a house move and stuff. And I said, you know, I started thinking, God, I've been away from this for 6 months. I'm really stressed. We're helping her move and getting things repaired and getting moving vans and stuff like that. I got home and I said, you know, I'm just going to go get a half pint. And a month or two later, 3 months later, by November, I'm drinking every bit as much as I did before. You know, so I can't drink like an ordinary person. I can't drink like a gentleman. I know that. I've tried it on my own. It's not going to work. So, you know, here I am, and I'm raw. This is, you know, this is it. It feels good. I prayed before I came here that if there's something that I can say that can help somebody else, that's all I'm here for. You know, it's just as long as any of us can help each other out. That's what we're here to do. And so I thank you for being patient and listening to you. Thanks.